WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Retired Valley delegate and JMU prof Pete Geeson has died. An exception is being carved out in Virginia for the ban on guns at state buildings. And we have the first in a two-part series on COVID-19 in Virginia's prisons. This is the WMRA Daily for Tuesday, April 6th. Former Shenandoah Valley delegate A.R. Pete Geeson died Friday at the age of 88. Geeson served more than 30 years in Virginia's House of Delegates, starting in 1964. Geeson came from a political family. His mother was the first woman elected to the Radford City Council and the first Republican woman elected to the Virginia House of Delegates. After retiring from public office, Geeson taught politics at James Madison University. On Wednesday, lawmakers in Richmond will consider an amendment to a bill they sent to Governor Ralph Northam earlier this year, banning guns at state buildings. The governor's amendment creates an exemption for magistrates, Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope reports.
One of the amendments from the governor that lawmakers will be considering during the one-day session this week is a bill introduced by Delegate Mark Levine, a Democrat from Alexandria. His bill bans guns in state buildings, and the governor wants to add an amendment creating an exemption for magistrates.
Magistrates are not ordinary citizens, right? These are people who have a position of authority. It's like Commonwealth attorneys. I'm not worried about Commonwealth attorneys so much as I am about some guy walking into a grocery store with an AR-15.
Philip Van Cleve at the Virginia Citizens Defense League says the amendment makes a bad bill a bit better.
We hate the bill. I would love to overturn this as soon as we can, but the more people that can carry, the safer the buildings will be. It may be a magistrate who happens to be carrying in one of these gun-free zones that might end up stopping a bad guy.
Lawmakers get an up or down vote, no amendments. Either they approve the bill with the governor's amendment, or they reject it all. Michael Pope.
The General Assembly will also consider Governor Northam's request to legalize the possession of small amounts of marijuana starting this summer. Whitney Evans with VPM in Richmond reports.
Under the governor's proposal, on July 1st, Virginians can legally have up to an ounce. There will be no retail sales or sealed containers, but there will be an open container law in place for transporting marijuana. The challenge, says Senator Scott Surivel, is determining what an open container means when the law was written with the assumption the state would have retail sales in place.
If you'd be buying marijuana from a retail location, you know, it'd probably come in a labeled and marked bag with somebody's name on it, with weight shown, and it'd be a little easier to figure out if the so-called container had been opened or not.
Law enforcement groups say this will be difficult to enforce. Advocates say the unclear policy will allow police to continue to use marijuana possession as a basis for extending traffic stops.
That's Whitney Evans reporting. For working families hoping to support their children, a new job might help, but who takes care of those children while the parents or guardians are working? More families are now eligible for state help, but only for a limited time, Virginia Public Radio's Jed Khalil reports.
For those hoping to start a new job, finding available childcare is often tricky, but the concerns don't stop once they find it. Emily Griffey is Chief Policy Officer for Voices for Virginia's Children.
Parents may think, is it even worth it for me to earn this wage or to start this career path if I'm going to be spending that amount of money in childcare?
If a family has a child under 5 and they earn up to 85% of the average income in Virginia, they're now eligible for subsidies. Previously, you had to be working to get the help, but not anymore.
It increases the eligibility for parents when they're looking for work, even if they're unemployed but looking for a job, they can now be eligible.
More than $200 million in federal stimulus money is funding the program. Some of the funds are to help keep child care centers open. According to the governor's office, 90% of child care center programs have reopened since being closed by the pandemic last year. These businesses are often staffed by women. Families have until July 31st to apply for the subsidies. Once approved, they get them for a year. I'm Jad Khalil.
We're beginning to learn more about what will happen to the Confederate monuments that Richmond took down last year. The city council will sort through more than 20 proposals. VPM's Roberto Roldan reports.
There's a long list of groups that want to take ownership of the monuments, from the U.S. Navy's Historic Preservation Arm to neo-Confederate activist groups. They're all vying for 14 Confederate statues and iconography. So far, City Council has put together criteria to evaluate the requests, including whether the new owners can pay to move the statues out of storage. Government agencies and nonprofits will be given preference. There's still debate about whether Mayor LeVar Stoney's administration or city council staff will negotiate the transfers. Either way, they'll need final approval from city council and two other commissions, a process that's likely to take months.
Roberto Roldan reporting. Finally today, it's been more than a year since Virginia's prisons locked down to try and stop the spread of COVID-19. The state has offered vaccines to every inmate, but restrictions are still in place, and they are unlikely to be lifted anytime soon. In part one of a series, Virginia Public Radio's Sandy Hausman explains why.
The state of Virginia won praise when it made vaccinating prisoners a priority, something it did on the advice of public health experts like Dr. Bill Petrie, a professor of medicine at UVA.
Prisons are a breeding ground for the virus, the opportunity for new variants to emerge, as well as to leave the prison through a correctional officer going home to his or her family.
But this bold strategic decision has not delivered on a promise to end the threat of COVID behind bars. That's because more than 30% of inmates have refused to be vaccinated. Tim Wright at the Green Rock Correctional Center and Tom Rose at River North say distrust is widespread.
Because the vaccines were approved on emergency authorization and they have not gone through full clinical trials and they have side effects, particularly the younger guys didn't see a reason to take a chance of injecting themselves with something unnecessary. A lot of people think we'd be in guinea pigs.
And Wright says inmates aren't the only ones refusing vaccine.
You had a large portion of the medical staff and a large portion of the officers that didn't take any of the vaccines either.
Despite the fact that five staffers have died from COVID, more than 40% of people working in state prisons refused vaccine. The Department of Corrections declined our request for an interview on the subject, but it's clearly concerned. It's got a six-person team at the international consulting firm Deloitte working on ways to promote vaccination and created a wellness channel on closed-circuit TV featuring medical experts and administrators like Director Harold Clark and his deputy, David Robinson.
While nationally coronavirus cases continue to rise, the number of active cases in the Virginia Department of Corrections has fallen. The role you play is vital in this fight, and I want to encourage you to keep your foot on the gas.
We are all in this together.
The state doesn't actually know how great the risk of future outbreaks is. 56 prisoners have died from the virus, but about 9,000 got it and recovered. The CDC says they should still be vaccinated, but officials don't know how many of those who refused vaccine might have natural immunity. Under these circumstances, restrictions remain in place. Inmates have, for example, had no visits from their families for more than a year. At the Fluvanna Correctional Center, prisoner Jennifer Blake says that's especially hard on parents.
That isolation, it is definitely taking a toll, especially between the mothers and their children. The majority of the women in here are mothers.
At Green Rock, Tim Wright says the lack of outside contact is fueling frustration and anger.
Everybody becomes a little bit more edgy, and they have fights over the microwave and fights over phones, and it's these things bubbling over because they've been penned up and have nothing to do.
Video visits are possible in some prisons for a price, $8 for 20 minutes, but inmates say the quality is poor, and there are not enough setups to accommodate demand. It can also be tough to use the phones or kiosks to send email. At River North, Tom Rose says gang members determine who can make a call.
Because you have 96 people in this pod, and, you know, it's just a lot of chaos. Got a lot of gang members in here, and out of six phones, they may have four phones. So, you know, the weak do not get on the phone.
In our next report, inmates share more details of life in prison during a pandemic, with few programs, poor medical care, cold food, and dangerous discipline. I'm Sandy Hausman.
And we'll have part two tomorrow. For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Thanks for listening. Stay safely connected and enjoy your Tuesday.